Jails have become warehouses for people who are poor, lack housing, or suffer from mental illness or addiction. They starkly reflect America's long history of racism. Those are the words of the National Safety and Justice Challenge. It is a challenge that has been accepted by several locations all over the country, including right here in Lucas County. And I welcome you to Rethinking Jails and Justice, a series of forums produced by WGTE Public Media in cooperation with Lucas County and the local Safety and Justice Challenge participants. I'm Jerry Anderson. On today's program, we continue our quest to answer questions posed by you, our viewers, as part of a live town hall streamed by WGTE Public Media back in early January. At issue today, youth crime and gangs and the criminal justice system. Many of you voiced concern with the number of young people in our jails. And before I introduce our guests, may I remind you that the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Safety and Justice Challenge seeks to reduce local jail populations, to do so safely, and to address stark racial inequities when it comes to the population of our local jails. I want to welcome into our program Dr. Adam Watkins, professor in the criminal justice program, Bowling Green State University since 2017. He has served as the graduate coordinator in BG's highly acclaimed criminal justice program. Dr. Watkins has researched and written about youth crime from angles including weapons in homes to resource officers in schools. He's also been part of research involving the Lucas County Juvenile Court. We're glad to have you here.
Thanks.
Also here on our phone line today, Dr. Yousef Woods, a founder of and director of facility at the Explorers Academy of Science and Technology here in Toledo. Dr. Woods will admit he beat the odds. His dad died when he was but 1 year old. Dr. Woods has three brothers who spent time in prison. He, however, did not. Is there something in his journey that can inform our discussion of kids in crime? I think so, and look forward to his words and his passion today. And did you know that parents from all over the country reach out to my third guest, Sean Mahone, Sr., born in Toledo? Can I say this? A child of a child.
Correct.
His mom was 14, as in years old when she had him. Probably not the kind of start that most of us think would give rise to a future senior class president at Rogers High School. Go Rams.
Go Rams.
And eventually he founded Young Men and Women for Change, a Toledo-based but nationally known behavior modification program. Now, it's more than fitting that the organization has the word change in it. I know that's not by accident, because what is it you say about change?
I normally say nothing changes if nothing changes.
Words that Sean has shared with me repeatedly. And so we're going to talk about changes today. We see swarming groups of young people charge into a store, taking whatever they want, paying for nothing, and facing no charges, we're told. We see street protests. Boy, many of those participants are young, aren't they? And one kid shooting another has, it seems, become almost mind-numbing headlines of the morning news in Toledo on virtually any day of the week. I worked in TV news, as you know. Toledo, by the way, and every other decent-sized town in America. To the point that you almost become callous to it. I'll get up in the morning, turn on local news, one kid shot another, and I say, wonder what the weather's going to be today. And I don't like that about me or any of us, that we become callous to that. Youth crime, based on what I've told you and so many others, is out of control. But is it? The Juvenile Law Center says since the 1990s, juvenile crime rates have steadily decreased. So, Dr. Watkins, what do we know about the trends, anyway, of crime and kids?
Up until the pandemic, the spring of 2020, the trend was very, very favorable. Going back to the late 80s, early 90s, the rate of youth crime in the United States, and this was also true locally within Toledo and within the state, was very, very high at that time. Mm-hmm. Since the early 90s, it was a precipitous decline, basically an unprecedented decline in the rate of youth crime nationally. But it is indeed the case from the spring of 2020 through the summer of 2021 that the rate or uptick in youth violence went up pretty precipitously to an unprecedented level.
I see that in all of my research, Sean Mahone. You see it daily.
Correct.
Tell me about the increase in crime that you see.
So I agree with Dr. Adam. What we find is because the pandemic, things have kind of just skyrocketed and went through the roof, especially starting in our education system. When we talk about the children that were, home, doing work from home and wasn't really being productive and successful at doing that, which led them to go out into the streets and kind of get into other things and to get into mayhem where it was starting not to only affect the homes, but it was also starting to outpour into the community. And so they made it very, very difficult for anything to be done because of the simple fact we had just walked into this pandemic and none of us was expecting for anything to change or what was going to happen at that time. And it was just like a big wow.
Yusuf Woods joining us on the phone line. You work around kids all the time. Have you seen that trend as well, Yusuf?
Yes, I have. And I've seen it in the area where our young people, we had to make sure we had one-on-ones with them because they felt hopeless. Mm-hmm. And they didn't see a way out. So we had to inform them, that this is what's going on in the world now, and you can make it through it, and you can adjust, to be a better you, because a lot of them, they had a lot of fear going on.
I want to pick up right there. Yusuf, hang with me for a second.
Okay.
It's not fancy, but when I retired from the glamorous life of local television news, I became a bus driver, a yellow bus driver for the Bowling Green City Schools. Mm-hmm. We went through that whole pandemic thing. In fact, Bowling Green City Schools stayed on remote learning longer than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
When we brought all of the kids back in to school, I didn't expect it. I don't think anybody did. My supervisors are saying, in all of the administrative meetings, the administration, principals, counselor, teachers are saying, we've never seen kids. This is just the rank and file cross-section of kids in a nice, comfortable Wood County school district. We've never seen kids act out like this. What do we think happened?
Well, it certainly severed a lot of the social relationships that existed leading into the pandemic. And some of that is indeed reflected in the self-report data, where we ask young people as to whether or not they feel lonely, feel depressed. And some of those social connections that existed prior to the pandemic were obviously severed. It is an unfortunate reality that for a sizable minority of young people throughout the country, that schools clearly play a very critical role in developing those social relationships and connections.
Sean Mahone, I want you to go with that because you guys do have a working relationship, I think a very viable one, with Toledo's public school district.
We do. So we're very grateful and thankful to have an outstanding relationship partner with Toledo Public Schools. The one thing that we have been able to do prior to us being partners with Toledo Public Schools, we were actually connected with another charter school, a community school here, where we provided some extra service. So what we did to kind of bridge the SEL, they call it social emotional learning, was we were literally going out knocking on doors, making sure that the youth were getting on the computer doing their work. We wanted to make sure they were being fed. And then we went as far as getting a facility downtown where we actually picked up those children and brought them to a safe place where they were able to get not only behavior mod, but education and also mental health as well, behavior health.
I think this will inform part of our discussion upcoming. Wasn't that long ago you get in trouble at school, boom, get them out of here, suspend them.
Mm-hmm.
Where is that putting that kid? Isolated, alone, away from others, as they were during the pandemic, and maybe we shouldn't be then so surprised the way young people are acting out following pandemic when those same set of circumstances have touched their lives.
So what we have done with Toledo Public Schools now is our organization has been able to successfully show with the data that we've been able to reduce out-of-school suspension by 90-95%. So with the accountability piece that we do, we make sure that we help those teachers, those principals, assistant principals, those who work in the building to build that healthy relationship with not only the staff, but also building a healthy relationship with the parents and child as well.
You heard those numbers right there at 90-95%. I know you're out there saying, Who is this again and what is his group? We're going to talk much more about young men and women for change right here in Toledo. You know, our preachers and our Bibles say we were all born into sin, right? So why do some kids go on to become criminals and gangbangers while others become Eagle Scouts and class valedictorians? Yousef, your story might help us out here. I mentioned earlier, your dad died, you were a baby, right?
Yes, sir.
And I'm sorry you grew up without your father. My life would not be close to what it is if I hadn't had my father in my life. I'm just telling you, folks. And that passing in some ways also kind of cost you your mom as well. Explain that to our listeners.
Okay. I had a father that was very well connected in the house, was married. My mom was with them. They were friends from childhood. And they end up getting together. They had me and my three other brothers. It's five siblings all together, but she had four boys. I'm the third oldest. And then we have my younger brother in Detroit, Michigan. And so what happened was she was so in love with this young man because he treated her like royalty. So she ended up in the hospital due to some complications through her pregnancy. And what happened was my father took ill because he was taking care of me and my three other siblings, mm-hmm. and then taking care of my mom while she was ill in the hospital, pregnant with my younger brother. And so he would go back and forth to work, pick us up, take care of us, go to the hospital to make sure that she was fine. So my father had asthma. He was very sickly coming up as a little boy. And so what happened was it was so much on him, he ended up having an asthma attack and died on the third floor. My mother was on the second floor in the hospital, and he was on the third floor at the same hospital.
So unbelievable.
Sick. Yes. And so he ended up dying. And so when my mother learned of his passing, she just lost it because that was her anchor, was her everything. And he was such a great provider for me and my siblings. And so my mother turned to drugs, and, you know, that's how she coped with the situation. Okay.
Stay with me a second. This is Yousef Woods, by the way. And her grandma, I mean, in essence, she raised you. And she had rules. Is it fair to say she saved you?
Yeah, oh, most definitely. And my mom. So she said, no, my grandchildren would never go into the foster care system. Give me my grandchildren. So while my mother was rehabilitating, my grandmother was raised. She took me and my brothers in, and my younger sister, and she raised us. And she raised us in the fear of the Lord, saved, sanctified woman. And she taught us morals, how to be respectful, how to respect ourselves, respect adults, and all of that. But I had three brothers. They was with it at first, but, you know, as you know, I don't care what your parent may go through, that child, we want to be with our birth parents, no matter what. Mm-hmm. So some kind of way, by the time they turned like 14, 15, my older brother and my younger brother was 13, they ran away from the home to go find my mother, and they found her, so they end up staying with her. So she had a lot of negativity going on during that time. It wasn't a lot of rules. So they went to the streets, started selling drugs, joining gangs, because they were hurt.
Gotcha. They were hurt. Right. You stayed with Grandma and her tough rules, and you followed those. Let me toss this out there. Our broken homes and families, to my guests here in the studio as well, are broken homes and families the biggest predictors of kids turning to crime? Or is that not a fair statement?
Well, it's certainly the case that most young people that grow up in those types of homes do not go on to be actively involved in criminal or delinquent behavior. Most do not.
Thank you.
Is correct. Are they at an increased risk? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But I think it is very important to state that the vast majority of those youth do not go on to be actively involved in the more serious acts of crime and violence.
And we as a society should not target them as such.
Correct.
Look at their upbringing. You know where this is going to go. Totally unfair to them.
Yes.
Because you could have somebody like Yousef come through with flying color. Sean, you want to weigh in?
I think it's also important to understand that there has to be effective programming in our communities, in our schools, that can give kids the positive interventions that they need. You've got anything that is a negative when it comes to the certain type of music that they listen to, what they're viewing and seeing on social media. There should be programmings, more educational programmings, to allow our children to understand the dangers of those and allowing them to understand why it's important to make the right choices and decisions being in those type of environments.
That programming should come from where, please?
I think the programming should come from organizations within the community, having a school-based program as well, and then also even in our local churches. And so the more programming that we have that goes from the schoolyard to the churchyard to the community yard, there has to be more effective programming to take place.
And I'm guessing my friends in public education, I'm thinking of Romulus Durant, I don't know, I'm sure you've had discussions with him, are saying, you know what, the state is going to grade us on how our kids are doing in reading and math and science and all of this, and now you're asking us in some ways to teach character and culture and values to kids.
I think Dr. Durant has done an excellent job with manifesting these magnet schools for opportunities for those students. That are going to learn how to do auto tech. They can do nursing, nature. There's a lot of programs that the district has pushed forward. What there's a lack of is that we don't have something in our educational system that can look towards those youth that are considered to be frequent flyers or those who are not on the radar to get those type of opportunities. So there needs to be a school that can be basically focused on those who everyone does not want to be bothered with. And that's when you begin to pour into those young folks and giving them the same opportunities that others are getting, but they're unable to get because where they're at and because of the social disconnect.
Yusuf Woods, the school that you co-founded, that in 3 years you're at 260 students already.
Yes.
Wanting to grow a grade each year, this year and the coming year, would like to actually add on pre-K on the young end and ninth grade, because you go through eighth grade now. Is that such a program that we're talking about? Is it designed, and I know you're using science, the whole STEM approach to teaching and education, but is it also designed for at-risk kids, or does this have nothing to do with at-risk kids?
It's for any student that want to learn STEM. And I want to go back to what Mr. Sean Mahone spoke about, and yourself, Mr. Anderson.
Yep.
The number one thing is we don't need teachers or administrators that's not passionate about our students and our kids. Because you do have a group of people that works in the school that's just there for the dollar. Mm. Most students, I would never forget, even when I was going through my Valley experience, I was in the first grade, and my teacher detect, no, these behaviors that I'm seeing out of Yusuf, he's trying to tell me something. So she took time out with me, and I will never forget her. Her name was Miss Dukri. And I'm almost 55 years old and still remember that because she spoke positive words. And she was watching negative behavior, and that changed my life. So how can we get the kids don't need negativity at home, and then when you come into the education system or in the community that we're beating them down and telling them that they're not anything and that they can't make it and, oh, you're dumb or you're slow or anything like that. What our kids need is someone, first of all, to show love. Are we going to win to everyone? No. But guess what? There's a group of people that will listen. I've seen Mr. Mahone for 18 years. Work in our community with our young people. And for him to be still going forth after 18 years, I know he has success stories such as I do.
I have an educator to my immediate left here in the studio who is doing some nodding as well, Dr. Adam Watkins, criminal justice professor at Bowling Green State University. Public education being called into question here in the role of teachers. And again, I guess role models in general. Weigh in, please.
Certainly what was being spoken to in terms of having positive role models and positive mentors, the evidence suggests, perhaps unsurprising to anyone, that indeed does matter. And these, you know, working in these environments, as these men know well, is indeed challenging. And one of the things that the pandemic brought up was some of the attrition that we indeed have within some of these professions, not only in community-based agencies that are meeting youth where they're at, social workers, intervention specialists, police officers, probation officers. We found that that pandemic period, which was accompanied by a rate in crime and violence, tended to exacerbate some of those underlying issues with regard to retention and training of personnel. And it is indeed the case that the certain apathy can set in working in these types of environments. I can say for myself, I used to work prior to earning my PhD in group homes. I came to realize that some of the most troubled youth were not actually in secure detention facilities, but rather housed in group homes with some of the most severe behavioral issues. And I can definitively say in my time working in that capacity that I did become apathetic. I enjoyed the work a great deal, but I started to question what it is that I was doing. And needless to say, I just wasn't as effective as I could have been once some of that apathy set in.
Who was putting these kids of promise in the same neck of the woods in the same facility with the bad influencers?
In terms of who was making that respective...
Who ran the group home?
It was funded through the state. Faith-based and nonprofit organizations generally facilitated, and they did critically important work. There was no question. Nobody had any question about these were youth that could not be in the home. They just simply, they posed too much of a risk to themselves or other youth in the home.
So again, a societal problem clouds efforts to address criminal justice reform. You know, in our town hall, we featured a segment. You folks, if you saw it, remember this. And you can watch it. It's online. We featured a segment on systems versus community, asking which was the best way to address and pursue criminal justice reform. Not suggesting that it has to be just one or the other, that it could be a twofold attack, but systems versus community. And certainly we learned that systemic changes, as we have seen in Lucas County, from cops to courts to the probation piece and coordination there to the mental health care system, from public defenders to the assessment of risk posed by people being held in local jails, those systems changes have produced results here in Lucas County. And Sean's saying, dot, dot, dot. Hold on there, Anderson. Go.
So what we find, Jerry, is this. There is a lack of accountability. And when I mean a lack of accountability, that goes from the top down. So I'll give you an example. I've been doing this program for 18 years. Been very successful in it. People are coming from all across the country. But when there's a disconnect between organizations and our local court, then we have a bigger issue because we are dealing with a juvenile court here in Lucas County that will not tell parents that there's a program here that might can help you. When you're not given the opportunity to develop partnerships with your court or with your local police department, it becomes a bigger issue because what's happening is parents are now not knowing what to do. They don't know what direction to go. And so a lot of people type in the word boot camp. And when they type in boot camp on Google, we pop up. We pop up number one. And so when people say, I didn't know we had a program like this in Toledo. And so we have to go back to, again, the accountability. Who do we start holding accountable for not allowing, just not myself, but other agencies and organizations that can fill the gap of brokenness in our community?
Let's go this direction because, Dr. Watkins, you've spent some time evaluating, right, the way Lucas County's juvenile court deals with young offenders. You think they are doing, when we talked earlier, quote, good job managing those offenders. What do you mean by a good job when you hear what you just heard from Mr. Mahone?
Well, leading into the pandemic, Lucas County, as well as across the state, vastly reduced its reliance on detention. And by detention, I mean secure detention and traditional detention or DYS facilities comparable to a state-run
DYS adult. Department of Youth Services.
Correct. Facility. So my point of reference in this case are these institutional settings. Leading into the pandemic, Lucas County had made a fairly considerable investment in cooperation with the state to try to build up community-based services to serve some of those youth that otherwise would have been committed to a detention or secure facility. And what they were able to do, as was true in other places throughout the country, was to achieve, to not compromise the safety of the community while still managing some of those youth in a community setting. And so, I applaud those efforts. And at one time, and I remember this quite well, I've been studying the juvenile justice system now for, easily two decades. Mm. And there was a time we thought it was an intractable problem, Jerry, that we were never going to be able to reduce our reliance on institutional placements without compromising the safety and well-being of the community.
If you don't put them behind bars, they're going to go out, they're going to reoffend, somebody's going to get hurt, and this is just going to perpetrate ongoing behavior.
Yep. And
we now know that's false, don't we?
Yes, and I believe that too for a while, that I seriously questioned whether or not we could make serious reductions in crime or violence while also reducing our reliance on institutional settings. That's not to say that, alternatives to those traditional settings can't work. I believe that they do. I think the evidence suggests that they can work, taking the form in some cases of what Sean is talking about.
So what we're dealing with, and I respect what you said, Dr. Watkins, you absolutely are right. The problem is, and what we miss out on, is that there's a bigger rabbit hole to go down. When we have officers with Toledo Police, when you have officers that are disappointed, upset, frustrated that they are arresting youth, they take them down to the juvenile court. 20 minutes to an hour later, a parent has to come and pick that child up. My fight has been for the community is those youth that are not serious violent people. Right. I find that what are we doing to teach these youth accountability so they don't reoffend? Because that's exactly what's happening. When you are just getting a slap on the wrist and you're sent back out the door, the attitude is, I don't care about the police. I don't care about getting in any type of trouble because there is no accountability there that is helping that youth understand this is the reason why you need to go down this road and not that road. So we're talking about police officers who have sent their children through this program. We talk about Toledo Fire Department people who have sent their kids through the program. Even a judge has sent her own child through the program. And so what we fight is we fight those systemic racism in a place where, again, I'm always saying nothing changes if nothing changes. So we find ourselves behind the eight ball. I've been doing this for 18 years, and I've seen more parents bury their child before the child or children are burying their parents. We had a story with a young lady who got shot and killed last year on the north end of Toledo. And there was a mother who was literally crying out for help because her child was a runaway. And when the courts are not providing those services to those parents, unfortunately, this young lady lost her life. And so now we have a parent who have, like a thousand other parents who have called us, are now reaching out to the juvenile court asking them, is there any program out there that can help? And the juvenile court is just simply saying no.
I want to follow up on that because, as we mentioned earlier, Young Men and Women for Change, you've been on my program, my TV program, over the years. Mm-hmm. This isn't something that came together in January of this year. We're talking 18 years worth. They know about you.
They do.
I want to know why, when Young Men and Women for Change has been active in this community, attracting people from all over this country, and I do want to get to your success rate.
Okay.
And I'll get you there.
Okay.
Why the juvenile court system would not reach out to them as possibly a first alternative, or at least an alternative to young offenders?
Because they do not like the word boot camp. And I've spoken to the juvenile court, and I've said to the juvenile court, you mean to tell me that the people that fought for our country went through a boot camp? When police officers go through an academy, they go through a boot camp style. And so they said, research.
Is this physical?
It is physical.
Are kids hit?
No.
That's where I'm going with this.
Right.
So you know what people are thinking when they hear boot camp.
So
they're thinking that drill sergeant and the pounding of the chest and all that kind of stuff. That's not what happened.
That's not what this is. Now, do I raise my voice? Absolutely. And the reason why I raise my voice is because I need to wake that child up now so a parent don't have to scream and yell because she has to identify her child's body later.
The kids that come into your program, they're not sentenced there. They're not forced there. This is an option.
This is an option.
Who is making that determination?
The parent is.
The parent, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I agree with Mr. Mahone. After they leave the first offense for me, I feel like they should be recommended to a service such as his. Because I don't even give it two chances. You see it the first time, you see the first things that's going on. And to answer the question for me, I might get in trouble for saying this, but I don't think you care that much. Because if you really care about these young people and these families, if you have a program like Mr. Mahone's in the community, it should be a line all the way from 75 to 94 to Detroit, Michigan. Because they should be automatically recommended to a program such as his to get them, to get their mind. Just, we have a room in our school called Refocus. And in Refocus, we don't suspend our kids. We want to make sure we get them back on track. So even if they did the first thing, Mr. Mahone should be able to go right downtown to get youth detention center and say, hey, or you should be calling, having that name, a program like that on your Rolodex, sending them, because sometimes people don't feel like it's their children or their family. Sometimes people, they get immune to the problems, and then they think they're helping, but you're really not helping, because you should be sending them straight to a service to get rehabilitated, because we've been in a different world. These young people are in touch with technology like you've never seen before. So a lot of things are being picked up on TikTok, social media, and you have to reprogram them. And Mr. Mahone, we just had him at our school a couple of weeks ago. I had him sit down with one of our young little boys at the school with his grandmother. And guess what? Ever since he left, that young man been on track.
Wow.
And he's watching everything that he's saying do. And Mr. Mahone flat out told the grandmother, if you want me to pick them up, if you want me to come and get them, we need people to think like that that's working downtown in the youth detention centers to make sure we get our young people, because they're totally different than what we were. This a whole new world.
You're a kid, 1970. Okay. Yusuf, you hang in there. I'm going to go back now to this. The average age of a youngster that comes into your program?
Five. 5 to 17.
That young?
5 to 17, yes.
Okay. I'm 13. I've been in trouble regularly. Mm-hmm. The system keeps kicking me out, telling me don't do that. I've been suspended from school. That just gives me free time. I don't have to go to school. Now I got more time on my hands. I walk into you only because my mom insisted. And I didn't have a choice in the matter if I wanted to eat. So she's bringing... What are you going to do to me? Because I'm telling you, you can't break me. I don't even want to be here. I'm going to do what? How long? I'm going to be here for 24 hours?
Right. So we, our signature program we've been doing for the past 13 and a half years, that program is called Dose of Reality.
Uh-huh.
And the Dose of Reality program is where youth and parents come to us on a Friday night at 8 p.m. Parents must do a two-hour parent accountability program. And then the youth is with us until 5.
At the time they bring the child in, the parents are going to take 2 hours.
Right. Absolutely. So we work with the parents and children together, and we let the children know, we let the parents know, we're not here to hurt your child, we're here to help your child. Is it tough love? Absolutely, but we would rather show them tough love out of love before the street show them tough love with no love. That program by itself, we've had people that come as far as all over the state of Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, Kentucky, Pennsylvania, New York, Illinois, Florida, North Carolina, Atlanta, Georgia, and as far as Phoenix, Arizona. And so we've had over 1,000-plus youth and parents that have been through that program, and only 237 children have been back. So my fight has always been, this is a much-needed program in our community, but let's not focus so much on the word boot camp. Let's look at why we call it boot camp. The boot stands for Behavior Obedience Observational Training. The camp stands for Community Adolescent Modification Program. We only use the word boot camp as an attention getter because through our census and data, that is what people are looking for.
I'm still the 13-year-old smart aleck who just came into your program. My mom just sat through her two-hour session with you. She's gone, and you're still not going to touch me. Let's just get this over with so I can go back out and live my life. What are you going to tell me?
I'm going to tell you, when one make a mistake, everybody else here is going to pay the price. So we take control of it the minute they walk in the door. So there's no lipping off. There's no disrespect. You're going to learn how to say yes, sir, no, sir, yes, ma'am, ma'am, yes, ma'am, ma'am, no, ma'am. You're going to learn all of that as soon as you walk into the door. That's what we call our breakdown process, okay? And we dub live videos on Facebook just to show exactly what we do in our program. And so we normally hold parents accountable. We make parents do push-ups. And we make parents understand that in order for this to work, guess what? I got to break you down and build you back up too, so I can teach them how to be firm, fair, and consistent.
You would have our listeners know that young people in those situations, you believe and you used to work in the Department of Corrections down in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
You believe kids, when they come to you, they face one of three outcomes.
Always, it was three outcomes. It was either prison yard, graveyard, and homelessness. I'm going to take away the homelessness and say that it's prison yard or graveyard. If you don't turn your life around, you're going to pay the price sooner or later in life.
All right. You're listening to WGTE Public Media's program, Rethinking Jails and Justice. Today, the accent is on young offenders. We've been talking about systemic change, and we're hearing about community programs. You know, there are folks out there, if you watched our town hall meeting, from a mayor to a county commissioner, other folks who say, yeah, that's fine, but what is broken is bigger than all that stuff. Families are broken. Society is broken. Social media is broken. Our respect for life is broken. As I say it, please keep me down from high places and away from sharp objects right now. It can get depressing after a while, but let's push toward what needs to be done and by whom. This is Rethinking Jails and Justice in WGTE Public Media. Our forums grew out of the Safety and Justice Challenge, a national effort to reform our criminal justice system, an effort Lucas County became part of about a decade ago. The streets are the best recruiting grounds for gangs. Dr. Adam Watkins.
Well, traditionally, that has indeed been the case. There is some concern about the role that social media may play in attracting youth that otherwise may not be drawn into gangs. I can say that you can certainly identify examples where that is indeed the case, although, unfortunately, there's not much empirical evidence to suggest truth to that. But we can say that it is still the case that one's immediate environment, neighborhood, does play more of a prominent role in deciding whether or not somebody is gang involved. The reality of the situation is I never had to make a conscientious decision about being involved in a gang because nobody ever asked me to be involved in a gang.
Yeah.
For some youth, they are conscientiously confronted with that on a regular basis, given the nature of the neighborhood that they grew up in. But even the empirical evidence suggests that in the most troubled neighborhoods, that the likelihood of a youth becoming gang involved over their lifetime is about 1 in 3. And that's even in the most troubled neighborhoods based on the evidence that we have.
Wait, that to me is a startlingly high statistic.
It is. But in this case,
in three?
1 in 3. But we're talking about a relatively small percentage of neighborhoods throughout the country that have especially heightened rates of crime. But it is. That is a troubling statistic. There's
Yusuf
no doubt.
Yusuf Woods, I'd like you to weigh in on this because you've observed this over the years. You had your brothers who, when they left the home and went out on the streets, that led to problem, that led to prison. These people out there who are recruiting young people, they don't necessarily come across as evil, mean, or nasty. They're not here to scare me as a kid. In fact, aren't they trying to come across as my friend? I want your words on this, Yusuf.
Some of them actually try to parent our young people. So what they do is they give them praise. Oh, you know, you're my top guy, or I can't do this without you. So what they're doing is praising them, and they are receiving that praise because some of these people are not receiving it at all. So that's first way of getting somebody in. One of the first ways of getting someone into your gang is letting them know that you're the top man. And that's what happened with my brother. He started selling drugs at 13 years old. And he was in the gang at 13 years old. At 14 years old, he had $50,000 to $60,000 in his pocket. And he owned homes at 17 to 18. So what it is that praising and just willing them in with all those great accolades. So that's one way. And another way is, African, and you can help me with this, Sean, if you can. Most African-American males, we want to be successful the right way. But sometimes we just can't wait for all that. It's too long of a period. That's what I've noticed. A lot of the young people that's been in the gangs or that's in the gangs now, my younger brother, the one I spoke with, Durrell Woods, Commissioner Durrell Woods, he was the smartest one in our family, straight A's, business mind. So that's one way they get in too, is you get that quick dollar or you get that quick fix, and then you can move on and you feel empowered with that. Money makes people feel like they're empowered and make them feel successful. But like Mr. Mahone said, it doesn't lead to anything but the grave or to jail. So my little brother, he realized that, and you just got to hear his story on how he ended up in prison for 29 years. It led him into a bad situation, but going inside to prison and being in prison for 29 years for something he didn't do, because he was hanging around those people that was telling him he the man, or you my top guy, or you the king. They actually use words like that. And I'm from Detroit, Michigan, so it's on a totally different level.
Hey, Youssef?
So, yes, sir.
Your brother Daryl did 29 years in prison.
Mm-hmm.
What's he doing now?
He's the police commissioner for Detroit, Michigan.
Are you ready for that? He is a police commissioner Detroit, Michigan.
Yes.
I knew the answer when I asked the question. I wanted to get that out there. So we look at gangs, and Toledo has a significant gang problem. My guests are nodding yes?
Yes.
Okay. It starts with filling a void.
Correct.
Positive reinforcement, something they're not getting at home.
Correct. That is correct. So a lot of our young men gravitate to the negativity out there because there is a lack of fathers in the home. So the young men, they want to be loved by a man. So if I show a youth tough love, they embrace the tough love. They want tough love, because there's no one in their life that's holding them accountable and giving them the tough love. And that's one reason why we have been successful as a program, because when I work with these youth, I tell the youth, I speak life into these youth, and I tell them, I believe in you and I love you. If I didn't love and care for you, I wouldn't spend a whole night with you trying to get you to change your ways. And so what we have done now for this summer, you know, I want to get like 10 young men, and this is coming out of my own pocket, but getting 10 young men and being able to do something productive with them every single day, meaning taking them to maybe, you know, take them to a trip to Louisville so they can see the Muhammad Ali Museum, take them up to Detroit so they can see the African American Museum, like get them outside of their community to help them understand that there's a whole world of opportunity out here.
So I'm the 13-year-old smart aleck in mm-hmm. your program, and you're telling me I want to hear a tough love message.
They do.
That is part of first breaking them down and showing errors up there. But instead of leaving them down there in this pool of misery, it's the bringing back up.
It's the bringing back up. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's the bringing back up. So, yeah, that's what they want. They want to know that someone cares. And what it does, too, is it helps those young, especially young men. We deal with young women as well. But helping them understand that you cannot disrespect your mom. You can't disrespect your teacher. You know, you have to understand, like, there's greatness inside of you. When a youth understand that you're speaking life into them to help them understand that there's greatness inside of them, that's what it is. It's a saying that we say within the church world. We say it's the anointing that destroys the yoke. And so when we do that, we are able to save more lives, and it's just been more impactful for us.
I promised the audience I would ask you, prove that it works. Tell me about how many kids go through your program, how many have positive outcomes?
So the 18 years that I've been doing it, we've helped over 4,000 children. Our success stories, and one of our biggest success story is a boxer that's from Toledo. He's getting ready to be the next heavyweight champ. His name is Big Baby Jared Anderson.
He's a fighter, man.
He's a fighter. He came through our program when he was 10 years old.
Jared did?
Jared came through our program when he was 10 years old. And so I'm not taking credit for his success. We were just glad to be part of the process with him getting to where he's at.
4,000 children come through. There's recidivism in all areas, it seems, of criminal justice.
Mm-hmm.
What is your recidivism rate?
Our recidivism rate is our success.
This is people who go back out and reoffend.
So that will be right at 15%.
That's it?
That's it. Parents... Again, this program has grown because we have been effective in what we do. One thing that we've done to really help parents feel more comfortable is not only do they get a dose of reality program, but if that child gets home and those behaviors begin to resurface, all the parent has to do is pick up the phone and give us a call. We normally try to modify the behavior over the phone. When we're unsuccessful with that, we're going to show up at your home or your school. That's where the Toledo police comes in at, because when there's an issue and the police have been called, when we come or myself come, we de-escalate that issue. We are able to talk and work with that child and simply tell the police, you can go on, we'll handle it from here. And they go, oh my God, what type of program is this? And we tell them, and they say, well, how come we don't know anything about it? I said, well, unfortunately, your chief of police don't want you to know anything about it.
Guess what? The secret's out.
The secret's out, yeah, right. The secret's out.
As of this program, the secret is out. Somebody said it in our conversation. I'm going to raise it, because believe me, it's out there in the community. The father in the home.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of folks look at, it's a black community thing. We know that's not the case.
That is not the case.
No.
And
no.
I want you to go with that in terms of, what do we as a society do with the family that doesn't have a dad?
So I can give you an example. My son, Sean Jr., I raised him from the time he was 2 up into 18. He'll be 21 in November. He went to St. Pat's from pre-K to 8th grade, and he graduated from St. John's in 2022. And so St. John said to me, we wish we have about 100 of your sons here, because what he displayed. What I say is, I tell parents this, and I'll say this publicly, what I do for my child, I do for yours. So if my child is going to be successful, then your child is going to be successful. We have wanting to have, for the past 18 years, I want there to be a facility where we can house kids for 30, 60, 90, up to 120 days. If I can get those young men to come to a facility where they can learn character building, value clarification, social and life skills, character building, then what we can do is we can start leading them in the right direction through a behavior modification program that's going to help them be more successful, and to so they can beat the odds against them. I was blessed to come up during a time where I grew up in the 700 block of Oakwood, and I came up during a time where crack cocaine was dropped in my neighborhood, and I had a choice to make. Either I was going to sell it or use it. But I always tell people that the boys and, well, it was boys club at that time, not boys and girls club. That boys club saved my life, because it gave me an out. It gave me a reason to go play basketball. It gave me a reason to go swimming, which kept me off the block doing negative things. And the people there at the boys club was there to give me that positive reinforcement and be a mentor for me to stay out the way.
There is an elephant in the room of criminal justice reform when it comes to reducing racial inequities. The Local Safety and Justice Challenge, for all of its successes, admits that goal on the adult level remains unmet. They were not able to, at this point in time, significantly reduce the seeming racial inequities in the local jail system. When it comes to kids now, if the percentage of youth involved in the criminal justice system, in jail or a juvenile detention facility or program, if it doesn't reflect the racial makeup of the community, does that necessarily mean the system is racially biased, unfair, fraught with inequities?
The system is flawed. There is no justice when it's just us. We make up the percentage of those as African Americans that's incarcerated right now in the United States.
In Toledo, Ohio, in the 2020 census, the black population came in at 28.1%. Are you saying that those incarcerated in the young offenders, we have more, is the population is larger than 28%?
Absolutely. That was in 2020?
That was 2020.
So let's look at the numbers in 2024 going into 25. I guarantee you those numbers are up. I guarantee it.
Why?
Because the system, so I'll give you an example. If it don't make dollars, it don't make sense. What I mean by that is the Ohio Department of Education pays $7,532 to educate a child. But if that child gets incarcerated, that state is going to get $36,000 a head off that child. So why are we playing games when we're looking at the injustice that's taking place in America? We're looking at that as a disproportionate number of African Americans that are getting slapped and getting dinged. And
you're suggesting
dumb.
A business model.
I am.
That says incarcerating black folks is good business.
It's real good business. As a matter of fact, if you look...
You get to take that professor back to the classroom. Let's get Adam Watkins back in here. Tell me what we're going to do with that.
Well, you know, one of the concerns that I do have about the focus on disproportionality, which indeed is an issue, and I do attribute it to systemic issues. And those systemic issues like poverty are obviously broad issues that require broad intervention. But I think in focusing exclusively on that disproportionality issue, which is an important issue, I think it does fail to recognize some of the successes that I spoke to earlier about the decline in the rates of detention and incarceration of young people leading into the pandemic, which occurred over a very protracted period of time. And those declines occurred among minority youth as well. And I think sometimes in focusing maybe exclusively or heavily on that disproportionality aspect, we fail to recognize some of the inroads or successes that were made. And I don't think that those should be overlooked. And there are important lessons, I think, to learn from that. And again, one of which is that we can effectively manage and deal with certain categories of youthful offenders, not to imply that detention or incarceration doesn't have a place. I believe that it does.
But for whom?
Generally, as you would anticipate, I adhere to the idea of graduated sanctions. You know, obviously, youth that have continued contact and you see an escalating rate of behavior moving into the direction of some of the dynamics that were talked about, moving toward gun violence, those types of things, that there is a place for detention because we know that there is serious risk of them being involved in those types of behaviors that pose a risk to society. But there was a period of time where we were just much more inclusive in the use of detention and incarceration, and we've come to realize that we can be more restrictive in our approach, even though it can be frustrating.
It's very frustrating.
It can be. And historically, I will say, it is indeed the case. It is indeed the case that many jurisdictions have struggled, and it sounds like it's not true in the case of Lucas County, and there may be these alternative avenues that are there that perhaps should be better explored. Is, you know, communities have struggled with finding services somewhere between probation and detention. Yeah. Those intermediate services, in some cases, have been difficult to sustain. Some of that is related to funding. You know, unlike the federal government, the local and state governments can't print money. They have a finite pool of resources. And generally, when most politicians or you know, elected officials walk into meetings, everybody needs more resources. Nobody ever walks into, you know, a meeting where somebody's talking about they need fewer resources.
And I knew I had it in my research someplace. The violent, this is anyway, violent felony arrest rate for young adults 18 to 22 dropped by more than 25% over 25 years, 1994 through 2019. We're getting short on time, but I want to do this as well. There's also the side of this when we look at systems versus the community. We have folks out there in elective office, and they're under pressure from the community. Get the kids off the streets, get them in court, get them in jail, and those voices come from people who vote. And therefore, elected leaders look at this as these are the people who put me in office who will or will not keep me in office, but then that runs counter to the very discussion we've had today as to what works.
What works. So we look at, I talked to Marcy Kaptur not too long ago. She heard me at an event speaking, and she said, "How come I never heard of your program?" And I said, "What do you mean?" She says, "I want a program like yours, and I make sure that the juvenile court gets funding for prevention programs, and they never told me anything about your program." So what we do, what should we do now? We got to start holding those people in position accountable. If you want our vote, tell us how you're going to serve by getting our vote. And being very transparent and very honest that you just don't blow smoke up our butt or anything like that, but just turn around and just being able to say that, you know, nothing changes. If nothing changes, let's make something change.
Yousef Woods has waited patiently on our phone line. Thank you for being here. The founder of the, it's a community school, right? I think they used to be called charter schools, community schools, Explorers Academy for Science and Technology. He knows a lot about this from living through it in his family. You have a couple of visions, because we're talking about making change. We're talking about what works. I would like you, in the short time we have left, Yousef, if you would please, Dr. Woods, briefly share those visions.
Well, our vision, I'm looking at Mr. Mahone, I agree with him. We need to have, just like we have people that come out of prison, they had to report to their probation officers. Mm-hmm. We should have a mentoring center where these young people have to report to their mentors or to that mentoring center to get resources and to be counseled and to be encouraged and to be rebuilt and rehabilitated to go back out into the world and to prepare them for the world. My brother does it in Detroit, where he have a key fob to the youth detention center in Detroit, where he's allowed to go in and get some of these troubled youth. He put them in his back seat of their car, take them to their parents, take them out to eat, do one-on-one with them, and then take them back. And a few of them have gone and aged out of that institution, and now they're in college.
Mm.
So it's rolling up our sleeves, like Mr. Mahone said. If you're going to hold an office in this community, be about it. Just don't talk about it and give a good game and get good talk before the people. No, let's see. Give us your stats. Who are you helping?
Mm. So mentoring center, is that the one you called the Savior's House or something like that?
The Savior's House. That's what I'm working. It's called the Savior's House.
Right.
Yes.
Sean Mahone. Mahone's founder of Young Men and Women for Change. What do you want to leave our listeners with today?
First of all, I want to say thank you to Explorers Academy. They have allowed me to come along and be in a partnership with them to help grow their school base, also to help deal with behaviors and making sure that we reach out to young men in that school to make sure we give them the best service possible. But what I would like to leave with the community is that, again, nothing changes if nothing changes. And we have to be in a position or a place that if we want a greater change, then we got to change the people that are not willing to make the change.
Dr. Adam Watkins, professor in the Criminal Justice Program, Bowling Green State University. Thank you for being with us today. What would you like to leave with our listeners?
Maybe two things. One, I've had some concern since the spring of 2020 about undoing some of the juvenile justice reforms that I was speaking to leading into the pandemic, specifically less reliance on detention and incarceration. Mm. And we have seen some states such as North Carolina, Louisiana, and others undoing some of those reforms, theoretically making it more possible to perhaps rely on detention and incarceration to deal with youthful offenders, despite the considerable body of evidence to suggest that that is not an effective response.
They're moving more that way.
Correct.
Lock them up.
Correct. Because of the uptick in youth violence, and I do not mean to diminish that. I understand the pressures that politicians are under, and I understand the very real concerns that residents of those communities have when you're talking about serious violence. But nevertheless, we have more than three decades of research to suggest that that is not an effective response. And I do feel as though it is a somewhat knee-jerk reaction, again, not to minimize the severity of those offenses, which are very serious, that just is not in recognition of you know what the evidence suggests. And then secondarily, there is evidence to suggest that there has been less investment in communities since the pandemic, and I encourage any of the audience listening, if you have an opportunity to make that investment, I suspect if they're listening to this, they care very deeply about their communities to make that respective investment.
My sincere thanks to Dr. Adam Watkins, BGSU, Sean Mahone, Sr. of Young Men and Women for Change, Dr. Yusef Woods, Founder, Chief of Facility at Explorers Academy of Science and Technology, for joining me here today and for the work they continue to do in our community. Special thanks to all of you for listening. We're going to keep the conversation going in June as we continue Rethinking Jails and Justice on WGTE Public Media. I'm Jerry Anderson. Thanks for being there. Let's talk again.